Oh, hello. You're probably here about the story. Elves love to tell stories.
Episode of the Talking Tolkien podcast. I'm Patrick Santino.
And I'm Clifford Vickery.
All right, Clifford. Feels like no time at all since our last show.
Yeah, funny how it ends.
Oh, wow. All right. Yeah, so for this show, we got some good stuff to talk about as usual. Not too much because this is kind of a shorter chapter, but we'll talk about elves, we'll talk about luck, and we will start to deep dive, or not deep dive, but we will start to dive in to the backstory of Middle Earth. And we will begin describing some of the events of the Old Testament of Lord of the Rings, the Silmarillion.
Kicking off with Cliff's notes for Chapter 3 of The Hobbit, a short rest. So after stocking up in the Troll's Cave, the company keeps moving on. Danger feels more present every day. Moods are tense. Provisions are running low. And the Misty Mountains are in view, which Bilbo mistakes for the Lonely Mountain, and he's reminded of how much further there is to go. We aren't even in Wilderland yet. Gandalf takes the lead at this point and directs them into a strange landscape at the foothills of the mountains, scarred by deep gorges, in pursuit of Rivendell and Gandalf's friend Elrond. Eventually they come to a steep winding path down into a large lush valley. Elf voices break into song out of the trees, welcoming them, teasing them, and they arrive at the last homely home of Elrond. Tolkien writes here that they stayed long in that good house, 14 days at least, and they found it hard to leave. Yet there is little to tell about their stay. We learn a little bit about Elrond through allusions to the past, and that his house is basically perfect, no matter what your interests are. On Midsummer Eve, when it's time for their departure, their wounds have been healed, they're well stocked with provisions and advice. Elrond examines the swords that Thorin and Gandalf got from the Troll Cave, and he also takes a look at the map that Thorin's got of the Lonely Mountain and happens to notice some secret messages. And they're off.
Cool. Yeah, fun chapter. Kind of short, but initial thoughts?
Yeah, it's pretty interesting. It seemed like that sentence from Tolkien summed it up. Nothing really happens here, but it's a good point for some backstory because we are introducing some cool new characters and start to see a little bit more of the larger picture of the narrative.
Yeah, but a bit of stuff happens first. Like, they have to find it at the beginning. I thought the descriptions of that were pretty cool.
I mean, it sounded like a pretty cool landscape. It's akin to, like, certain landscapes in the American West where you've got like a flat plain or plateau with just gorges carved out of it.
Yeah, I mean, they were lost and they were probably super hungry, super tired, wanted to get finished for the day. But I mean, if you were going to be lost, that'd be high on my list of places to get lost in, I'd say. What do you think of Rivendell as a whole, last homely home?
It sounds awesome.
It does.
I could not think of a nicer sounding place.
A pleasant mixture of everything.
It helps that Tolkien described it as perfect, so sounds pretty perfect.
The descriptions of this kind of stuff, I don't know, maybe we haven't had enough yet, but most people, even as critics, usually ascribe that Tolkien can set a scene pretty well and make you envision a place that you'd really like to visit, and Rivendell is very high on most people's list. Of course, the name itself, Rivendell, it's one of those geographical things that we got again. It's probably an Adel, and there's probably a river going through it. Adel is kind of like a gorge, a wooded gorge thing, I believe.
Yeah, or just a valley, really.
Yeah, valley. Yep. Cool. And the last homely home, Clifford said, we haven't even gotten to Wilderland yet. By Wilderland, I mean, look at the big map in your book. We finally reached it. The last homely home is right on the far left side of it. So it's called that because it's on the borders of everything else is completely, absolutely wild.
Okay.
And so this is the last, basically, sanctuary before.
So elves. We've got elves here.
Ooh, we've met elves. Another classical fairy tale thing.
So elf, we've heard some references to them so far, but who are they? What are they like? Do we have any backstory for them?
Well, why don't you tell me what you know about them just from this?
They sound playful, a little bit mysterious, but overall very wise and put together.
Did they really seem wise? I thought Elrond seemed wise. I didn't think Gaston did.
I suppose Elrond definitely seems wise, but as a whole, they seem more put together than the dwarves.
Yeah, they seem much more carefree and goofy.
Uh-huh. And they have this established place that is theirs. They seem to be kind of just like wallowing in leisure. Like they've figured it out pretty much.
And I mean, it is the perfect place. I mean,
we're
using the word perfect to describe this.
They don't really feel like, they don't seem like they're lacking for anything.
So Clifford, so these elves, with all the goofy little laughter and everything like that, they almost sound something closer to something like this.
Another interesting elfism. There are only three jobs available to an elf. The first is making shoes at night while the old cobbler sleeps.
Lazy bum, couldn't even make a clock.
You can bake cookies in a tree. As you can imagine, it's dangerous having an oven in an oak tree during the dry season.
I want to make shoes!
But the third job, some call it the show, or the big dance. It's the profession that every elf aspires to, and that is to build toys. And that's Santa's work.
They don't seem like the epic elves of Lord of the Rings or Silmarillion. I don't know. Wise, I mean, all the tra-la-la-ly stuff, and I mean, the songs were kind of fun because they were pretty taunting, but like in a very playful way. But I mean, you know, they knew Bilbo, they knew some dwarves' names already. It's like, well, how do they know this kind of stuff? But, and I thought like the, I don't know, parts of it was like fun, parts of it, it's like, this is kind of stupid.
Yeah, so, I mean, how does this tie back to older mythologies? Like, we know the boisterousness and the joking seems similar to like a childish fairy tale depiction of elves, and honestly also of dwarves, which is an interesting comparison. Like, they're small, colorful people with beards and hats.
Elves don't have beards.
Well, okay, and I mean in the sense that the dwarves are playful. This description of elves sounds almost like a Snow White description of dwarves.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, that's what we got to go off of here. He makes the lines in there like, the dwarves don't have any time for elves because they think they're silly and stupid. And like, the narrator is just like, well, that's a very unwise thing to think because elves are very wise. So the narrator stating, yeah, they're legit, they're important. But I don't think you actually see that at all until you meet Elrond, personally.
Right. Right.
Yeah. And then, go on.
I don't know if we go into this at all, but the depiction of both elves and dwarves in the movies and in Lord of the Rings is quite a bit different from what we're seeing here. Like, elves seem much more serene and mature and wise put together in the Lord of the Rings books as well as the movies and the Hobbit movie than they do here.
Well, so the movies were just keying off the books, like, for sure, without a doubt.
Okay.
And of course, the Hobbit movies were made after Lord of the Rings. Mistake. But there's a change from elves in the Hobbit to elves in the Silmarillion, like deliberate changes that I don't think it really be appropriate to comment on them until we actually see those changes in Lord of the Rings.
Okay.
Yeah, we can get into Elrond, but I think we should save him for a little bit later in the episode. I don't know, that almost kind of just leads us straight though into our big main topic here of luck.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, do we want to touch on Elrond's home in Rivendell?
Well, we can mention it. What did we say?
So, Elrond's home in Rivendell sound pretty nice, and Tolkien literally calls them perfect. What do we make of this in terms of Bilbo's warming up to the adventure, but he's still longing for home?
He clearly
admires Elrond. He loves elves. He says that multiple times. And he wants to soak up what he can and stay because it's comfortable. But it's also, he's gotten to that point because of adventure and exploration. Like, it seems an interesting turning point for the, what we touched on in the first episode of Bilbo being, wanting everything perfect, easy now. Where he's now embraced adventure to an extent, discovered a new place. So it's like he's gone out of his comfort zone. This new he would be happy to stay in this new place. Does that count as him? Is that a cop out? Is that him like kind of reverting to his conservative? Is this fascination with Rivendell him reverting to homesickness and his old ways, or is this an embrace of the new?
I don't know. I think really. This is just kind of the high points that come with adventures. You're going to get out of your comfort zone, but then you're also going to find places that you didn't expect that are actually more comfortable than you could have ever imagined, kind of thing. Which I think is what Bilbo's experiencing here. And that's just good with the bad on that one. This is a lucky time for...
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. What do you think?
I didn't really know what to make of it. It seems like... Like, yeah, if he wanted life to be easy, it's the perfect place to stay.
Maybe he will someday. Maybe he will.
Okay. I'll keep that in mind, Patrick. The last homely home seems like a big relief for the company. They're healed and well-fed. And it also seems pretty lucky for the rest of the story, because when they show Elrond their map, he happens to be looking at it at just the right instant to notice some hidden runes on the map. Moon runes that you can only see when the moon is in a particular place in the sky. And this actually helps unlock a part of the puzzle of how they get into the secret back door into the Lonely Mountain.
Right, so what map are they looking at again?
This is the map that Gandalf passed on to Thorin at the very beginning. It's Thorin's map that he received by way of Gandalf from his father and grandfather of the Lonely Mountain.
Yeah, this
and they're
the
hoping
one...
to use it to basically steal the treasure back from Smaug.
This one should be in everybody's books too. Along with the big map of Wilderland, there should be the specific map of the Lonely Mountain. One thing about that is it's orientated with east on top, I believe. Kind of weird. We're not used to that.
Really? I noticed that.
Yeah, it takes a close eye. And okay. Elrond had a close eye as well when he read this. Because like you said, it's the place the moon is, because, I mean, the moon would move throughout the night, but it's the shape of the moon, which I guess is its place based on the universe. But yeah, I mean, it had to be, I think, a crescent moon to read this thing, and it had to be on the same night, which is Midsummer's Eve. So, by the way, Midsummer's Eve... That means we're already like another month ahead, because now we're in late June.
Right.
And the way the Middle Earth calendar actually works, Midsummer's Eve is actually at the very end of June. It's almost like it's actually not even reckoned within months. It's just like an extra two days kind of thing, or 3 days maybe.
I think. Interesting. Okay.
Yeah. We'll talk about that at some other point. But yeah. So we now traveled 2 months and they're here. And so the map says. Well, the map drives the plot forward, really, because now we find out more information about how we're actually going to get into the Lonely Mountain. It seems that we have an alternative to just walking up the front door and knocking to have Smaug let us in.
Right. But it's totally a coincidence that Elrond happened to find this out for the dwarves at exactly the right instant.
Well, they keep using the word luck, which might imply like coincidence or chance or everything, but I mean, just to actually think about that, no. it just can't be. Period.
You think it's something else going on?
Yeah, I mean, like, some people, this is a complaint they sometimes have, is it's just like, oh, man, he just lets luck be such an important part in the story, and, I mean, it's bold that this would actually happen. But no, luck's an important part of the story, because it's not just, like, chance, I'd say. I mean, it's... you know, the chances that you read the map with on the correct one day of the year that it can be read on with the exact shape of the moon that you need at night is, it would take literally and figuratively astronomical odds for that to occur. So I think there's just more going on than just chance here.
Sort of fate almost.
Yeah, I think fate gets closer to it. Fate meant to be. I think we'll have to keep going, read more into it. But from what we learned from being able to read the secret runes that the moonlight revealed to us, they're going to need just as much, probably more luck, to actually get all the way to the mountain and be there at the right time. Because
why is that?
Well, there's a bunch of conditions of where they have to be to find a secret door into the side of the mountain.
All right. Shall I read through some of those conditions?
Yeah, you got them.
Stand by the gray stone when the thrush knocks, and the setting sun with the last light of Durin's day will shine upon the keyhole. So in other words, they've got to be standing in the right place, on the right day, at the right time, and the thrush has to knock on something, and the sunlight is going to shine or point to whatever the keyhole is. So that's a whole lot of coincidences that have to line up. It's like planets lining up almost.
It is.
And what is this specific day, Patrick? What do we know about Durin's Day?
Durin's Days do not happen once a year. They're a fairly rare occurrence. So we're already dealing with something where they're only going to... Yeah. We know it has to be around the end of autumn, but... So that gives us a day to shoot for. But we don't really have any idea if Durin's Day is actually going to come up this year or not. So... They're just going to have to hope it is one. Maybe they...
Are you sure about that? Because it says Durin's Day is the first day of the last moon of autumn on the threshold of winter.
Yeah, but the sun and the moon have to be in the sky at the same time. And that doesn't happen every year.
No?
The moon has to be in the sky. The moon has to be visible at sunset. That's not always true.
Okay. So you're saying the dwarves' New Year doesn't happen every year?
I don't know if they're saying that's New Year, if that's Durin's Day. Does it say New Year?
Yeah. Durin's Day is the first day of the Dwarves' New Year, said Thorin.
I know. It's kind of weird. God. All right, maybe we should just assume it is.
Okay.
Okay. But we're going to have to talk about this later. Okay. All right. Well, then let's restart parts of that. Yeah, so Durin's Day, I mean, it says it's the New Year there. You can assume that happens once a year. From what I've read, it might not actually be. I guess we can kind of discuss that as we get closer to Durin's Day. We just know that it comes at the end of autumn. So we're going to have, like, again, some more celestial bodies aligning once again in order to see this keyhole. And we also need a specific bird, a thrush, knocking on something or whatever. And we need specifically gray stone as opposed to, I guess, some other colored stone. I guess
brown stone.
Brown stone. I don't know. Black stone, maybe. But yeah, gray stone.
Uh-huh. Okay.
So yeah, this will be a tall order for them. They have to make it there on time. I don't think it'd be a spoiler to say that they have many adventures to go through before they get there.
Indeed, indeed.
So hopefully they make it on time. So we're saying it's currently midsummer eve, so end of June, and they have to get there by the end of fall. So that gives them, I don't know, 6 months?
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, no, less. More like 4 months.
Well, I think the end of fall is technically December 21st, right?
I suppose so. Okay.
Unless they're going to do the equinox, then they only have like 3 months. Or, I don't know, whatever the end of fall is. So they have until the end of fall. Yeah, so they have from late June to... I mean, our end of fall would be on the winter solstice, which is like December 21st. Though, I don't know when they consider their seasons actually changing in Middle Earth, so maybe it's a couple months earlier. At most, they only have 6 months.
Right.
And I don't know exact mileage, but doable, but...
We have some foreboding foreshadowing.
Yeah, I mean, it's a tall order all around. Well, Clifford, we're 3 episodes in. I think it's about time that we introduce the readers to the whole backstory of Middle-earth, the part that was firmly established at this time of writing, becomes the story of the Silmarillion. It's the... Well, what do you know about it?
I see it as sort of the testament of Lord of the Rings. Like, it's a collection of these stories that are kind of the founding documents. They set the backstory for these epics that come later. There is one large narrative, but it's comprised of a ton of smaller stories. In the same way that the Old Testament or a lot of the written aspects of older mythologies are. Kind of like what we were saying about the Edda in the previous episode is actually just a collection of a whole bunch of Norse stories compiled into one text.
Just to give fair warning here, we're not actually going to end up spoiling anything from Lord of the Rings throughout this whole show because, you know, maybe there's like 10% of this audience that's never read Lord of the Rings and we're not going to ruin it for them. We're just going to help them along the way. But with the Silmarillion, that's an extremely, extremely dense read. It's a very difficult read to the point where it also almost assumes that you do know the general gist of it. Just like how people know in like the Bible, everybody knows the Noah's Ark story. Everybody knows the whale story where Jonah gets swallowed by a whale or something like that. You know the pieces, but how does it fit together? You don't know that until you finally read the whole thing. Just right. Like with the Silmarillion, you've heard all the backs. You should be accustomed to all the famous stories in it, but you don't know all the details of it, and you don't know the order until you finally read it through. So we are actually going to go into those backstories. The only order we're actually going to give you is right now, because I'm going to give like a synopsis of it, and then we're actually going to talk about one of the famous stories from it, because I've been hearing a bunch of references to it in this chapter with all these, with Elrond and all these Gondolin references we got.
What reference is that? Where's Gondolin coming from?
Mostly from the swords that Gandalf and Thorin had.
Which they got from the Troll's Cave in the previous chapter.
Yes, correct. Bilbo also got a small one that he uses as a sword that would have been, I guess, a dagger.
Right, okay.
Yeah.
So, the Silmarillion. Yes. Hit it.
All right, this is going to be a lot to summarize. Lots of names coming at you. Lots of stuff you are going to vaguely understand, but... Try hanging with me here. So, this world's created by one head god.
This world, is Middle-earth we're talking about?
Yes, this is Middle-earth. And, of course, Middle-earth is actually just our world. It's just kind of before time or before any of our time or anything like that. It's some far-off story that takes place in our Earth, basically.
Okay.
Yeah. So, in this universe, in this creative world, there's one head god. And his name's Eru Iluvatar, and he has a bunch of angels. Now, these guys are angels, so they're lower than him, but they kind of act like the Greek pantheon or like the Norse pantheon of like gods. Like there's like a one you can think of as Zeus, and another you can think of as whatever. And they create the world by making this great symphony of music. But then the head god Iluvatar actually sends all the gods in who end up being like the Greek gods to be actually rule over the world, and he himself is outside and not a part of it.
So the all of these angel type demigods become a part of the world.
Yes. So there's about 15 like big huge name gods, and then there's quite a multitude of lesser demigod kind of things.
Okay.
Yes. So one of these, of course, becomes supremely evil. His name is Melkor. He's the mightiest of all of the angels. And, of course, we're dumbing this whole thing down, but he's the mightiest of the angels, and he's so powerful that he has a bunch of battles with all the other gods combined, to the point where sometimes he has the upper hand, and so whenever the gods fight, the world becomes different and breaks apart, to the point where the main story really begins with the Valar living on one sliver of land at the...
Who are the Valar? The Valar are these angels.
The Valar are the biggest of the angels, so the biggest, like the head Greek god kind of guys is what you can kind of think of them as.
Okay.
And so they're actually living on one sliver of land at the very far western edge of the whole world, and that area is called Valinor. And at this time, there are no sun and moon, there's only starlight up in the sky, and then in Valinor, there are two beautiful giant trees, one's gold and one's silver, that radiate light for everybody in Valinor to see, for all the gods. Meanwhile, Melkor, the evil guy, is living in Middle Earth, and he's kind of like just dominating the whole thing. There's like animals and creatures at this point, but there's no like living or no conscious beings really, besides his followers, because some of the minor gods were like, oh, Melkor's kind of cool, I'm gonna follow him.
Okay, so Melkor is in charge of Middle-earth, yeah. And the rest of the Valar are in Valinor.
Right. And Middle-earth is the continent where everything takes place. All of Lord of the Rings, all of The Hobbit here. It's at the western side of the continent, but it's the whole Middle-earth map is just one part of that huge continent.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Okay.
Cool.
So what happens next?
Yeah, so the first thing that happens is the head god, Eru Iluvatar, when they're making this symphony of music, he introduced the idea of men and elves, and that was exclusively his own idea, and so they are the children of Iluvatar.
So are they on par with the Valar?
No, they're below the Valar. So, I mean, it's like Eru's on top, then the Valar, which Melkor is the mightiest of the Valar, and then after them is the Maiar, which are the rest of the angels that are just lesser.
Okay.
And then it goes elves. Because elves are the firstborn of the children, and they're the eternal things, like what we're seeing, everything you saw in the chapter, they're all like great and mighty and carefree and everything like that and fun. Uh-huh. Almost perfect. Some people have said elves are kind of like humans before the fall, or I mean man before the fall, like Adam and Eve kind of thing.
Okay.
I can imagine that. Of course, they're eternal. Like, they won't die unless they're killed in like a battle or something like that, but they don't actually age or get sickness. So they were created, and then one of the Valar is actually roaming Middle-earth, and he finds them. And he's just like, man, these guys are sweet, but Melkor's going to mess with them and screw them up, so maybe we should just take them back to Valinor where they'd be safe. So they do that, but before they do that, they actually do a whole fight a whole war against Melkor just to protect the elves so that they could have a safe journey over. And now, though Melkor is super powerful, the Valar actually, all of them put together, actually defeat Melkor and bring him back in chains and lock him up in Valinor.
Okay, so basically the Valar went into Middle-earth and they brought back all the elves and Melkor, and everybody's hanging out in Valinor now.
Except some of Melkor's cronies got away. Like, some of the bad guys, they didn't, like, go all in depth to find them all or whatever.
Okay.
But yeah, so everybody's basically hanging out in Valinor. And now there's a couple branches of elves. Now, some elves didn't actually refuse the call to go to Valinor, and they don't get to go. And so they're called dark elves, because the rest of the elves that do go are considered light elves, because they see the light of the two trees, and it's like...
You see...
Your face is different. Like, there's a change to you once you see these trees, because it's, like, such a beautiful light.
Okay.
So everybody's chilling, hanging out, and, like, life's perfect. And then one elf, who's named Fëanor, who's part of... His kindred of elves is called the Noldor. He ends up creating the Silmarils, which is where this book gets its name. And there are a couple gems...
What are the Silmarils?
They are three gems that... capture the light of the two trees and preserve that light within them.
Okay.
Now, Melkor, he's been in jail this whole time, but eventually a couple eons pass and they decide to release him and only put him on house arrest. Probably not the wisest decision, because he's the most evil thing ever, but that's what happens in a mythological tale like this. So that takes place, and surprise, surprise, he goes and recruits another bad guy. It's a giant spider, actually. And they go and they end up killing the two trees. They steal the three Silmarils that are around. And then they run away back to Middle Earth.
So terrible, terrible idea to put them on house arrest.
In hindsight, yes. For most people, they didn't even need hindsight to see that, but yes.
Okay.
Yeah. So now the gods are super sad at this point. Or the Valar are super sad at this point and like kind of distraught. And really, they don't really have a game plan. Now, Fëanor is just absolutely pissed because the Silmarils were his most prized possession. Like, he worked real hard on those things. He'd never make anything like them again. So he riles up all of his kindred to be like, you know what? You know what? We don't need the gods here. We're gonna go back to Middle-earth, and we're going to go fight a war against Melkor, and we're going to go get these things back, and we're going to destroy them in the process or whatever. But, you know, to the ends of the earth, I'm going to go get these jewels.
So this is, like... this is Fëanor leading all the elves? Like, some portion of the elves?
About a third of the elves, maybe.
All right, so he's leading, like, one of the main tribes of elves to fight a war against the most powerful demigod in the entire world.
Yes.
All right. Sounds a little bit foolhardy.
Well, you know what? They actually go back to Middle-earth, so they come back to Middle-earth, and for 400 years, pretty successful. lots of deaths along the way, Fëanor himself. But they do a reasonably good job. They don't actually get back to Silmarils, but they hold Melkor down and have him sieged, and he can't really escape or anything like that. They can't get to him, but he can't escape. And so they have peace in Middle-earth. They're ruling it and everything like that. But then eventually their luck turns because of some evil deeds that some of them did along the way. Again, this is where like the more in-depth stories come in, which we'll hit on throughout the series. But it comes down to, after 400 years of a siege, Melkor finally is ready to unleash his full might. He does. And all of the princes of the Noldor who went to take lands back in Middle-earth and to fight this war against them are wiped out within 50 years.
Damn.
Yeah. Now, there's a little bit of hope in the story because it actually ends up with a good ending. They get the gods and Valinor, the Valar and Valar and Valinor to actually come back and fight Melkor and defeat him again. Mm-hmm. But that is the end of the story there. When the story ends, there's still a 6,000-year gap from the Silmarillion to basically the Hobbit in the beginning of Lord of the Rings.
Okay, so what happens in that, or what goes down?
Many things happen throughout that, but for this purposes, though, I wanted to like give just a quick outline of the Silmarillion, because one of the main things that we kept hearing about was this place called Gondolin in this chapter.
Okay.
And also, Elrond himself actually starts to play a part at the end of this story.
Okay.
So this place called Gondolin, it kind of comes up halfway through once the Noldor are set back up in Middle-earth and they're sieging Melkor.
Uh-huh.
And one of the princes of Noldor, this guy's name is Turgon, he ends up building a hidden city to be the last defense because it's been prophesied that the Noldor are doomed to die. And so he makes a hidden city called Gondolin in the middle of some mountain range, hidden from everybody else, including his own family,
mm-hmm.
And brings a bunch of the kindred of elves that are following him. And they set up that to be the last refuge of all the elves. Now, eventually, all those elves are wiped out, and they do become the last place, the last refuge of all the elves. And it takes a while, but eventually Melkor even finds that as well. He decides to lay a huge siege to it because he's just like, okay, I got to wipe out all these elves. You know, I don't
so Gondolin is sort of like a last stronghold almost for a bunch of the elves.
It is. It is.
Okay. So the swords that Thorin and Gandalf have came from this battle when Melkor attacked Gondolin.
Yeah, because Melkor ends up finding out about it because one of the elves actually betrays him. Kind of surprising that an elf would betray him. Like, I mean, imagine the elves that are in this chapter. You think any of those guys would ever work with any sort of evil force?
No, certainly not.
Yeah, one of them did, though. One did.
Uh-huh.
And one cool detail was the Gondolin swords glow blue. And I wonder if that's because they were always in hiding and were always on the lookout that their fortress might be discovered. So I guess, you know, that's like, again, that's like a nice little token detail that like, oh, he's got swords that can glow blue. That's pretty cool. But I think that, you know, maybe that was for defensive purposes, like, oh, there's orcs around, we better hide kind of thing or whatnot. But
right.
Yeah, Melkor ends up finding the city and he sends all of his might against it. So this is like thousands of goblins at this point and dragons, many dragons. And these things called Balrogs, don't know if anybody knows what those are, but they're pretty evil too. And he sends about 1,000 Balrogs and dragons against this place.
Okay.
And you can kind of imagine that it happens at night, and so all these elf swords are probably glowing blue in the darkness, and it's like, oh, it looks like they all got lightsabers or whatever, and they're ready to fight.
Huh.
And so maybe you should think about picking up the Silmarillion, because this was a cool battle. This was like not even the top five biggest battles of this book, but 1,000 Balrogs and dragons attack this city, and the elves, they absolutely lose, but they put up a pretty good fight.
But in the midst of this, Thorin and Gandalf are holding the swords that are kind of a heritage of this battle.
They're holding two swords. They said Gandalf's sword is actually even the king, so Gandalf would be using Turgon's sword.
Interesting.
And Thorin's sword was called Orcist. I don't know who would have actually used that. It would not have been Tuor, who is another main character of this battle. There's this human, so he's not an elf. There's this human at this battle named Tuor, and he actually married the king's daughter. So a man married an elf, and they had. Now it wouldn't have been his. I know that wasn't his sword because he used a battle axe at it, which is kind of cool, hacking off heads and stuff. But They had a kid named Erendil, and so those three, Tuor, his wife, and Erendil, actually escaped this battle and run away with some of their, like, very few of their kindred, too.
Okay.
And eventually, Erendil has a kid, or has two kids, two sons, and one of them is Elros, and one of them is none other than Elrond, who is in this chapter.
Okay, so Elrond's a direct descendant of people from Gondolin, and so we've come full circle now.
Right. Just as a spoiler, it's Elrond's dad, Erendil, who ends up saving the day for at the end of the Silmarillion book.
Okay, good to know.
Now, so obviously there's a real big battle that ends the Silmarillion and everything. Like, the book's just filled with battles and death. Like, that's like a huge theme of it is just death. But clearly Elrond comes through alive and makes it all the way down to Lord of the Rings.
Uh-huh.
Like I said, in between the end of the Silmarillion and Lord of the Rings, there's 6,000 years. So that means Elrond, we know he's now 6,000 years old, which if you're around for 6,000 years, you play nothing or two.
Probably elves, wise. Do I take it to mean elves are immortal?
Yeah, I think I mentioned that. I think I said eternal instead of immortal.
Okay, so they have no fear of dying?
Do they have no fear of dying? Well, they don't want to die.
Can they die?
They can be killed in battle. But okay. When elves die, they end up actually just kind of living in, like, the houses of the dead, basically, that are in Valinor. Whereas when men die...
They basically return to their homeland.
Yeah, but that wasn't quite their homeland. But yeah.
Okay. Kinda. Okay. They go to the land of the gods.
Yeah. I actually completely forgot to mention men. Men are the second children of Lúthar. They end up coming, like, halfway through the Silmarillion, and most of them actually help Melkor and are, like, on the bad guys' team. But three tribes of them actually help the elves throughout, and they're rewarded with, at the end of the Silmarillion, after it's all done and said and done, they're rewarded with the island of Numenor, which they put halfway, or two-thirds of the way to Valinor across the sea.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So the men are a little bit less pure.
Yeah, I mean, the men in this story are like us. We haven't met any yet, but they're like us. They got all our faults and all our weaknesses.
Okay, they're corruptible.
Mm-hmm. Now, what's actually cool about men, though, is since they know they're going to die, just natural deaths and everything, they actually advance the story in the Silmarillion more because they're just like, hey, you know, I only got, if I'm lucky, 100 years, you know, I got to accomplish stuff within that time. Like, I can't be sitting around sieging some guy for 400 years or something like that.
Yeah,
like,
definitely.
Got to get the story moving.
Definitely.
Which we'll actually see, I mean, this is foreshadowing, but we'll actually see in the Lord of the Rings, it's the opposite. The elves are the cool ones, like the cool, like, we're not used to them kind of thing.
Uh-huh.
Whereas in the Silmarillion, it's actually the men who are like the cool, new, weird thing.
Okay, good to know. Yeah. But we haven't met any men yet in this story, correct?
Alas, no.
No. Mm-hmm. So we now know where Elrond comes from, where these swords that Thorin and Gandalf have come from, and yeah, we've got a little bit of background on the elves themselves. As part of this, we learn that Elrond disdains the dwarves' love of gold, but he also hates the dragon Smaug and the destruction that Smaug caused even more. Is he hesitant to help the dwarves? We learn that the dwarves aren't very into elves, but mostly because they think the elves are annoying. Is there, in the Silmarillion and throughout all these backstories, is there some historical enmity between dwarves and elves?
There is, but not between any of Elrond's people, like his specific tribe of elves, and Thorin's tribe of dwarves.
Okay.
So, I mean, but in general, elves and dwarves don't get very well along. I mean, as we've seen, dwarves are literally pretty down to earth. They're pretty materialistic. They're interested in goods and treasures and jewels and everything like that.
Uh-huh.
Whereas elves, it's like, yeah, they like beautiful treasure and everything, but I think the key word there is obviously beautiful. Like, they're more about, more so in tune with nature and
sort of aspirational, connected to the stars.
I mean, we haven't met men yet, but it's kind of fair to say, like, men are in the middle. On one side, you got elves who are, like, maybe slightly higher beings, whereas dwarves are more closer to the ground, animalistic kind of things.
Okay.
Shall we leave it there?
I think so.
Yeah, short chapter. Hopefully this episode is shorter. Don't really know. Yeah, housekeeping stuff.
Make sure you follow us on all of our social media pages.
Right, so email is Email again. You can email us at talkingtokenpodcast@gmail.com. Any sort of questions, eventually we'll probably get to them. Maybe we'll start answering them on episodes daily, on each episode. The Twitter, I screwed up. It's at Token Talking. Clifford made the correct Instagram, Talking Token Podcast. We got the Facebook page, the same name. Look for that. Check the website.
We'll have links to all of these from the websites.
Please leave us the reviews too. Can't harp on this enough. It'll be fun if people can leave some good reviews. Prizes awarded for 5-star reviews. If we read them out on here, they have to be witty. They have to be fun. They could be heartwarming. But yeah, the prize is a novelty, few of its kind, one shipment only of Talking Token Podcast beer koozies. So if your review is read out here, all you have to do is just contact me and I will send you a beer koozie for your enjoyment.
Which will be the envy of all of your friends.
Yes, your hands will be comfortable as you hold a nice cold beer.
Nice.
All right, Clifford. Well, why don't you have a good week, buddy?
Same to you.
Thanks. Thanks for listening, everybody. Clifford.
Thanks, y'all.